This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. The U.S. isn't at war with the Afghan people, President Bush says, but tell that to the citizens of Kabul or Kandahar dodging the shrapnel, or to the aid workers who have seen their offices and warehouses looted and destroyed. The U.S. may be battling Osama bin Laden, but the collateral damage is all over Afghanistan, and it's heading for the borders. Pakistan is already home to some 2 million Afghans. The U.N. High Commissioner on Refugees estimates that this war will drive out 1.5 million more. What is America's responsibility for the new wave of refugees as it fights the war on terrorism? First, tensions continue to rise in Israel today. Gideon Remez is the foreign news editor for Israel Radio. I spoke to him earlier today about the escalating violence.
There have already been two further rounds of shootings since Minister Zevi was assassinated yesterday. First, a car blew up near Bethlehem, killing the commander of a Palestinian militia there, which was connected with Yasser Arafat's own Fatah organization and who had been on Israel's wanted list for quite a while since he was blamed for a number of shootings of Israelis. The car blew up. Apparently a bomb had been planted in it, and Israel is not discouraging rumors that it was responsible. And just a few moments ago, we received reports that near Jericho, on the West Bank, three Israelis have been injured, one of them apparently critically, in another drive-by shooting. So that there does seem to be a further escalation. I hear a lot of helicopter action over my head right now in Jerusalem. And following the killing of that Palestinian militant near Bethlehem, there has been some fresh shooting at the Gilo neighborhood in southern Jerusalem, which we have not seen for quite a while now. So that what remains of the tattered ceasefire here apparently seems to be going to pot as well.
Earlier today, Israel issued an ultimatum to Yasser Arafat. What did that ultimatum contain, and was there a time limit to it?
Well, no, there was no time limit, and there was no clear threat of what would happen if the Palestinian Authority did not carry out the ultimatum, that is, did not extradite to Israel those responsible for the assassination of Mr. Zevi. These are apparently members of a militant group known as the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which only partially accept Yasser Arafat's authorities' discipline. It's unlikely, and in fact, the Palestinian Authority has already rejected the ultimatum. There was that Israel would list the Palestinian Authority as a terrorist group, with the unspoken meaning that Israel would launch further military action against it. Israeli forces were already in action today near, if not actually in, two central Palestinian towns, and that may have been the meaning.
In the past, when its national existence was on the line, Israel has resorted to preemptive strikes on its enemies. Is there any talk that there may be a preemptive strike brewing against the Palestinian Authority itself, something to perhaps even to topple Arafat and essentially attack his own forces?
That is precisely the dispute or the disagreement now within the Israeli government, which, as you know, is a broad and not a very united coalition. There are forces, for instance, the finance minister, who is one of the more influential members of the right-wing Likud party in the government, tonight called explicitly for Arafat to be banished from the area in the hope that some more effective and more moderate Palestinian leadership would replace him. This was rejected by his colleagues from the Labor Party, saying that Arafat is probably the only one who can hold the Palestinian Authority together at all.
Of course, this impinges directly on the U.S. war on terrorism, doesn't it? Can Washington restrain Israel now, do you think?
Well, the question is what is to be prevented. If it is perhaps a move of Israeli forces to take up permanent positions in the areas that up to now have been under control of the Palestinian Authority, that has been tried before by this present government in Israel, and later they were withdrawn under U.S. pressure. However, in Israel, there are some who feel that the cabinet may be, or at least the right-wing element in it, may be trying to, if they're trying to preempt anything, it will be an American move to force Israel to accept some immediate settlement or accommodation with the Palestinians on terms which the right-wing element here would not want. But following the assassination of the cabinet minister yesterday, there have been voices calling to state very clearly that the war here on terrorism is just as serious a one as the war that the U.S. is waging.
And for Israel, of course, Arafat is bin Laden, isn't he?
Well, that was the line that Mr. Sharon, our prime minister, tried to present right after the September 11th attacks. It was not well received. That doesn't mean that the terrorism on the part of the Palestinians is not to be condemned by the Americans. And in fact, they have condemned the latest act of assassinating a cabinet minister here. But I think most in Israel have realized that, the U.S. is not going to put Arafat and bin Laden on a par, at least for tactical reasons now of holding their coalition together. And I doubt that anyone in Israel is going to try and push that line much longer.
Gideon Remez, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gideon Remez is the foreign news editor for Israel Radio. I spoke with him earlier today from Jerusalem. Afghans already make up the largest refugee population in the world, with more than 7 million scattered worldwide. U.S. military airstrikes are expected to displace 1.5 million more. What should America do to help the refugee crisis? It is worsening. You can join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Joining us from New York is Nicholas D. Torrenti, Executive Director of the U.S. Office of Doctors Without Borders. And our news analyst tonight in the studio is Joan Vinaki, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Nicholas Torrenti, your organization has put out a statement criticizing the U.S. airdrops of food in Afghanistan, and yet you are a humanitarian and medical organization. Can you explain that?
Well, we raised some concerns that the airdrops of food in such an untargeted and unmonitored way would not be the most effective way of meeting the very, very great needs of the Afghan civilians. And there are as we know, the crisis in Afghanistan has been going on for quite a while. It actually predates the September 11th events, with hundreds of thousands of people on the move in Afghanistan looking for food, looking for security, with rising rates of malnutrition, with a very, very tenuous health situation, with epidemics popping up all the time. So this is a very, very serious crisis, and to be able to deal with it effectively, we need to rely on organizations on the ground who have evaluated the needs, who have established channels to deliver and distribute the aid to make sure it really reaches those in need. So it's just to say that the airdrops, even if they're well-intentioned, they're not really the most effective way of helping out in this very difficult situation.
Is there some connection between our bombing and these airdrops and the looting of your offices recently in Afghanistan?
Well, we're concerned a little bit about that, because the other concern that we had was that, you know, these are not airdrops that are happening by – they're not being dropped by civilian planes. These are dropped by military planes, and it's part of a really part of an overall military strategy. And it really compromises the image of the humanitarian organizations on the ground, their credibility, their neutrality, and they're seen a little bit by forces on the ground as being part of this overall military strategy. And we saw this sort of backlash early on when UN offices were attacked in Quetta, just the day after the bombing started and the airdrop started. And most recently, a couple of days ago, we had our offices and other offices of aid agencies inside Afghanistan that were ransacked by armed men in Kandahar, most probably by the Taliban. In Mazar, it's a bit more difficult to know, Mazar-i-Sharif, a big city in the north, because there are a number of forces on the ground. The situation is a bit unstable there. But really, we fear that there's the blurring of lines between the U.S.'s military action and the relief operation is putting impartial and neutral humanitarian agencies in jeopardy.
Hmm. Hi, this is Joan Vinaki from the Boston Globe. I think the average American would say, okay, well, they're not the most effective. The airdrops are not the most effective way of getting food, but isn't some food and medicine better than nothing at all? Do you see any value at all to the airdrops, or do you see it as strictly, you know, like a symbolism, kind of a public relations thing to make Americans feel better about the bombs that were dropping too?
Well, I think the American the officials have said it very clearly. There is a comprehensive anti-terrorism strategy, and as part of it, there's a military part and there's a relief part, and it's to really to show that the U.S. is hitting at military targets and reaching out to the Afghan civilians. So I think clearly it's part of that, and it is how the U.S. Administration officials have stated it publicly. In terms of the value to the people, well, it has some value, but it's very limited. If you, you know, if you're the one person receiving that one food parcel, it will help you for one day. But we're talking about a much greater crisis here, a much greater magnitude, and therefore, we really need to have a much bigger response and more effective response.
How can you do that? What would your advice or suggestion be? How can you do that while bombs are dropping, while the country is under attack? How can you have an effective ground organization?
Well, it's very difficult, and you're right to point it out. We were able to do so up until 2 days ago in most areas of Afghanistan through our national staff on the ground, continuing to have clinics and hospitals running, and we were able to resupply them with medicines. Actually, other organizations were bringing food in and trucks in even very recently. I think it's deteriorated in the last couple of days, and we're very concerned about that. We're really asking on the authorities who have the responsibility, basically the Taliban, to respect aid organizations and to understand that we're not part of this of any military effort that's going on. It's probably going to have to wait for things to settle down in terms of the bombing campaign for large quantities of food to be able to move safely.
What's the time limit here? I mean, how long can these people go without food and help? I mean, if this bombing campaign continues, what's the race there between the bombs and the hunger?
Well, we knew already that the situation was deteriorating sharply even before the September 11th happened and then before the bombing started, so that we were already in a race a little bit against time because of this, and also because of winter coming up, which is usually sets in Afghanistan about middle of November in some areas where there are high mountain passes even earlier than that. So there is that time limit. Right now there is still some supplies inside the country, but it depends depending on the area, depending on the population. So I would guess that in some places supplies have run out already and people are very desperate. In other places, we still have small stocks that would last maybe a week or 2 weeks, at least of medicines. In some of our areas, we know we've been able to restock. So it's a varying situation, but generally, of course, it's getting much worse.
Is there any way for the United States to know where it's worst and perhaps to concentrate airdrops right there, right now?
Possibly. That would be a possible way to help. We know that, for instance, that large numbers of displaced people, people who are already on the move in the country because of the insecurity and because of the drought, we're going to big cities such as Mazar-e-Sharif in the north and Herat in the west. There were about 250,000 people around Herat, huddled in sort of makeshift camps, and they were really dependent on international assistance for mm-hmm. survival. We had big operations there. We had feeding centers there. We're actually trying to get a convoy into Herat right in these days. Herat is not as unstable as the other places, and lootings haven't really taken place there. So that's one area where we think we should be able to put relief in. Other places, it's much more difficult right now.
Hmm. Well, it seems to me that we're talking sort of about the politics of food in a way, and making Americans feel better. But if someone were just to say to you, what's the one thing that we should do to make this more effective, what would that be?
And briefly, please. I'm sorry.
Sorry. The one way America could make things more effective?
Yes. In terms of alleviating the hunger that you're talking about, the crisis situation.
Well, I guess when the military operation comes to an end, I think things will be much easier. I'm not in a position to say when that's going to be, and I'm sure the American officials are taking that into account in their planning. And then
Thank,
and then to respect the independence of humanitarian agencies.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicholas Di Torrenti. Nicholas Di Torrenti is the executive director of the U.S. Office of Doctors Without Borders. We're asking about the Afghan refugees this hour. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking this hour about the collateral damage in this war on terrorism, the Afghan refugees. Should the U.S. be dropping food along with bombs? Are American military forces hindering humanitarian aid? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the conversation on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Our guests are Rina Amiri, an Afghan refugee and student at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and our news analyst, Joan Vinaki of the Boston Globe. Rina Amiri, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to have you here. Now, you have a story to tell us about your experience as an Afghan refugee that might help us sort of throw ourselves into the lives of the refugees today.
Okay. My situation is, I have to say, is quite different from the situation of the refugees right now. My family left in the 70s after our former king, King Zahir Shah, was overthrown. We had to leave the country within a matter of days. My father's life was under threat. It's hard to not have a political label in Afghanistan and many parts of the developing world. And my father had been a vocal royalist, and when the king was overthrown, he was told that we were going to be moved to another part of the country. That usually meant disappearing people. So we said my mother had a medical illness that needed advanced treatment in India, and we packed up a suitcase and said we would be gone for 6 months for treatment, and we left. We left our entire family. We left our home, all of our possessions, with the expectation that at some point we would be able to return. We went to Pakistan. That's the route that most. That's the route that all Afghans actually take.
What was that like? Did you do this on foot?
Were
you
in a car? No, our situation as we were fortunate. We had access. The people that you see in Afghanistan today have the only reason they're still there is they have. They don't have access to resources. They don't have connections.
Anybody who did is gone.
Exactly. And our family was fortunate. We had access to resources. We had connections. We had enough money. We ended up taking a bus out of Pakistan. As a child, of course, it was quite bewildering for me. I didn't know where we were going, why we were leaving. Our family took trips, vacations, where the entire family would rent a bus, and we would go to another part of the country. And I was puzzled as to why just the four of us, my mother, father, brother, and I were leaving, and didn't really register that we were going forever because the war never stopped.
The war never stopped, John?
Well, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, what's been happening in the years since you left. I mean, Americans pick up the papers now, and we see on television, you know, the pictures of these people who are, you know, leaving and desperate to get to Pakistan. But actually, it's been happening for 20 years. Can you just get into a little bit more, explain a little bit more about what drove people from their own country?
Of course. As you heard, we Afghans are the largest refugee population in the world. And people, our situation is not such that we left our homes because we were seeking economic opportunities. We left our homes because we didn't have a choice. Anyone who's left Afghanistan in the last 20 years has left because they've been branded as an enemy of the state by someone out there. We've had one wave after another wave of political violence, and the people who have bore the brunt of the violence were the civilians, the people who were innocent. My family left at the time when there were few people who had connections to the monarchy, or were connected to the political elite, left. After that, with the next administration, President Dawood, who had overthrown the king, his cousin, Dawood overthrew the king. From that period up until 1978, there were other people who had been allied to the king who left. After that, there were a variety of Soviet puppets that were coming in and creating more instability. So the tribe, the king's tribe, the Mamazays, ended up leaving. That I think they were the first wave. that left after that, between 1979 and 89, that's when you had the largest number of refugees leaving Afghanistan, because there was a life of terror under the Soviet regime. There was the terror that you see in America, that was part of September 11th. The things that people living with are now have been a part of life in Afghanistan for over 20 years, where you wake up one morning and you don't know where the threat is going to come from, and you leave your house and you leave your belongings, and you don't know what your destiny is. You just leave.
And then you get liberation from the Soviets, and you wind up with the Taliban.
Well, it was ironic, because after the Soviets left, there was both with the expatriate community, who had been waiting to see how they could contribute, and the Afghans within, who had fought so hard for peace. It was devastating to realize that peace would not come and the world would lose interest in Afghanistan, because the Cold War had been won. And between 89 and 92, a political vacuum emerged. And from 92 to 96, it was probably one of the worst situations in Afghanistan, where the enemy was within. Mm-hmm. One of the Mujahideen, who had been viewed as so heroic, started fighting amongst themselves, raping, pillaging, looting, killing. There was one Mujahideen leader, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who took it upon himself to bomb the capital several times, killed thousands of people, and much of the infrastructure damage that you see in Kabul comes from the devastation that he wrought upon the country.
And then the Taliban comes after that. Let me just give the phone number here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You just got us to the Taliban, and of course that's been a constant source of refugees.
Again, there was this hope that perhaps mm-hmm. this group would bring peace. That's the way that they came into Afghanistan, mm-hmm. claiming that they were going to bring justice and mm-hmm. an order. They did bring a type of order, probably the severest type of order that, actually I can say for a fact, the severest type of order that Afghanistan had ever seen, where Afghans had lost their home, they had lost their relatives, they had lost their infrastructure, and then they lost their culture, because the Taliban stole our culture, stole our voice, stole our religion. And we couldn't even, Afghans right now cannot listen to Afghani music in their homes. Mm-hmm. It is against the law. Celebration of our culture was against the law in some way, because they decided to bring in their warped sense of what Afghan culture was about.
Sure. Let's take a call from Joel. Hello.
Yes, I'm Joelle.
Joelle, I beg your pardon.
This has been most interesting, and I do understand that the United States had a role to play in bringing the Mujahideen to into power, and indirectly in setting up, therefore, in leading to the Taliban. What concerns me is, again, to go back to the distribution of food, that I don't think that it fits with the bombing. And I think when we bomb and we rather randomly drop packages without a proper distribution system, we defeat the purpose of it. I mm-hmm. think we, as well as killing civilians, you don't exactly offset that by dropping care packages. Mm-hmm. I think if we wanted to do an effective job of helping the starving civilians, firstly, we would not be bombing. We would be sending in specialized ground forces.
But, of course, that would put them at greater risk, wouldn't it?
Right, and we never like that. We like to drop bombs from...
Well, of course, those are American young men.
I'm perfectly aware of that.
Sure.
And I'd rather we didn't have to do this at all.
Sure.
But I think that using intelligence and ground troops makes much more sense mm-hmm. than saturating areas with bombing and then wondering why people are against us and
sure.
are not grateful.
Okay.
And as far as distributing food goes, it is best done, and I have seen it done, by the non-governmental organizations who have distribution systems.
And I think they want to get in there as soon as the violence is over, this campaign is over. Rena, how about that, the picture of the bombing, the food, and just the situation of the Afghan people today? I mean, the fear they're living through.
I was listening to the comments before I came on, and I've heard this from many people who work within the human rights field, that there's a deep concern of mixing the message of humanitarian aid with bombing. And I'm of the position that I want any type of food to get into Afghanistan right mm-hmm. now. Afghanistan has had a famine for the last 3 years, at least the last 3 years. United Nations Human Rights Commissioner Mary Robinson has likened it to the situation in Rwanda. Mm. And it's of a much greater proportion. In Rwanda, over 800,000 people died. In Afghanistan, I think you will see a catastrophe of a proportion that is going to be much greater than that if there isn't some sort of sustained humanitarian action. I don't think that the solution is just to drop the food. There are several problems with food droppings right now. One of them that I'm concerned about is the landmine situation in Afghanistan, that there are millions of landmines in the country. And if people are going to unsafe areas because they see food, are we going to increase the number of amputees, which are in the millions already? Mm. That's one issue. The other issue is that they may be afraid because of the propaganda war of the Taliban. I've heard have said things of the sort that this food, it has pork in it. It's going to, they're trying to take away from your religion by mm-hmm. having you eat this food. So I don't, there are several problems with it. And I do agree that the people who would be best fitted to deal with this, with the food situation would be non-governmental organizations.
And the UN. In fact, our next guest can help us on that point. Joining us now is Ginette Gebrekristos. She's a regional representative for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
Help us understand the dimension of the dimensions of this looming humanitarian crisis. What can we anticipate, and what can we do to prevent it or to mitigate its worst features?
Well, in the worst-case scenario, we expect that 1.5 million Afghans are going to flood into Pakistan and Iran, Tajikistan. For the time being, the borders are closed, and people are trying to sneak in, and that is sort of very difficult, making them victims to smugglers. Because both Pakistan and Iran have closed their borders. In some ways, we understand the problems that Pakistan and Iran are facing because they've been shouldering the problems of refugees for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. Pakistan has been a host, is still a host for 2 million refugees. Iran is a host for 1.5 million refugees. And the international communities has abandoned both Iran and Pakistan to shoulder the problem of refugees on their own for the past 10 years. And so the closure of border has actually taken effect since. So the UNHCR and the rest of the international communities have been appealing for more assistance to both Pakistan, Iran, to assist refugees to be able to open their doors mm-hmm. and to negotiate a temporary asylum for these people.
Temporary asylum in Pakistan?
In Pakistan and Iran.
And in Iran. When you say they sneak over the border, that means climbing mountains, and that's a formidable task.
Climbing mountains with all the danger, and they've been paying like 1,000 rupees per family, which is close to $100, which is extremely expensive for a population which has been impoverished by war, drought, and this is even more difficult for Afghans who come from the minorities, who will be taxed both on the Afghan side and on the Pakistan side.
Well, I'm just curious, when you see these, this last wave of sort of desperate, destitute people, do you think that they look at America right now as a liberator from the Taliban or as, the enemy?
Well, I would say that the feeling will be mixed. At this point, I don't think people are thinking this way or the other. All they're trying to do is sort of bring themselves to some safety. It's a very desperate situation for them. And what we as humanitarian people are looking for is for Iran and Pakistan to open their door, or for the rest of the Taliban or the U.S. to open a humanitarian corridor to reach these people.
What do you see as America's responsibility to the refugees?
Well, the U.S. has been one of the big supporters of the Afghan refugees from the beginning to the present. From the $12 million that has been so far received by UNHCR, $4 million come from the U.S. But this is a very difficult question to answer, I should say. But the essential thing is that people should be brought to safety. Borders should be open so that people can reach to safety.
Mm. Rena, would you like to?
I think one of the responses should be to have a series of a campaign to combat the catastrophic effects that this situation could have, in the same way that the strategy for getting rid of the Taliban is being thought through. There needs to be a sustained humanitarian action. The United Nations needs to get financial support. They're the best equipped to handle this situation. So rather than throwing symbols at it, rather than reassuring the media and the people that in some way these people are being given food, I think you need to look much more broadly. Afghans aren't just dying because of starvation. They're dying because they lack medicine. They're dying because they will start dying because they don't have shelter. The winters in Afghanistan are quite harsh, and at most they're only going to have some sort of plastic to cover them, because the majority of them are having a very difficult time getting into refugee camps. They're dying from treatable diseases like dysentery or cholera.
Mm-hmm. Gannett, this is the picture you see as well.
Yes, it's actually that the time is pressing, the winter is coming, and the borders have to be open. We need to be ready to mobilize either on the side of Pakistan or Iran or inside Afghanistan. And at this point, the appeal that is made by the UN is not really being made. The generosity of the international community is not being translated into cash money.
Mm. And what about and buttressing Pakistan? This is a tremendous burden for them, isn't it?
It is a tremendous burden for them, but there has to be some solidarity, both on the on the Pakistan side, but also on the international communities. And the Pakistanis are not sort of being accommodating the situation by giving camps that are in a very unhospitable areas in the tribal areas, mm-hmm. where there is no water, where the security is not possible. Therefore, even if refugees are allowed to come in and the camps are going to be in the tribal area, the yes. safety of the refugees and the safety of the humanitarian workers
is going to be
difficult.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you, Gannett Gebre-Christos. We're asking what the state of the Afghan refugees today, what's in their future. Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. This hour, we're asking the question, what is America's responsibility to the millions of innocent Afghans caught in the crossfire of the war on terrorism? Join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. We're here with Rena Amiri, an Afghan refugee, and Joan Vanocki, our guest analyst, columnist at the Boston Globe. Jay is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling to draw attention to another deeper issue that has not been covered in this conversation, and that is the lack of the gradual breakdown of civic structure of the society since the Cold War, when Afghanistan was occupied by the Soviet Union, and then when the United States, through the CIA, supported the arming of the Mujahideen. One effect of that was the lack of the breakdown of civic structure, the breakdown of families, the breakdown of farming skills. I think what we are seeing is basically the end result of 20 years of attrition of a society that was not, that was backward technologically, but still very stable. So,
what can be done to reinstitute this civic structure, to rebuild it?
Well, it's very difficult. It's very difficult because when a country has been used for as a pawn in the great game of the Cold War, and now again in this war against terrorism, the fallout of that is the complete breakdown of civic structure. I mean, here we are talking about food being dropped from the air and refugee camps and so on. It is another matter altogether to restore the civic structure or the agricultural structure of the country, of society.
So that people can grow their own food. This is part of the task of nation building after this campaign, isn't it, Rena?
Absolutely. And I think you're going to hear much more about this once the bombing campaign ends, once the next stage, hopefully when the opportunity for peace finally comes to Afghanistan, this will be an issue that will have to be dealt with. Afghanistan was a poor country, but it was a stable country. There was a tribal society, different parts of the country had tribes and different families living there. That provided some form of stability. You had institutional leaders within those tribal units.
And it provided food as well.
Absolutely.
Communal agriculture.
Afghanistan has always been a very decentralized country, mm-hmm. even at the time when there was a peace, at the time when the king ruled Afghanistan. The resources that were brought into the country, it ended up going to the bigger cities and the rural areas. It was the tribal leaders that were able to distribute food or to create the mechanisms for agricultural support. That no longer exists. And in a way that I think it's more pressing to talk about is what we're hearing a lot about is the Loi Jirga as a mechanism for bringing peace.
The tribal councils.
The tribal council that has been traditionally used as a mechanism mm-hmm. for reconciliation and peace in Afghanistan. Well, what you need for that is leaders, tribal leaders. Mm-hmm. What concerns me is that in many parts of the country that no longer exists, whole families, whole tribes have had to leave. Mm-hmm. With that vacuum, you're going to have a very difficult time even using the traditional mechanisms of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be an even greater problem. I think the international community has to come to the recognition that it will have to do nation building. There's a great deal of concern, and I know we're going off target, but sure. from the United Nations and the U.S. about who's going to do the nation building, right. or should we? Absolutely, it has to be done, because in the last 20 years of war, every aspect of Afghan society, of Afghan infrastructure has been destroyed. The international community has to take the responsibility to build it up again.
How optimistic are you that there really can be peace in Afghanistan? I mean, after the 20 years of all of this turmoil and war and the fabric of the country being torn apart the way, you know, you're describing it, do you really think that it can happen?
I don't think,
out of all of this, you know, bombing and the war against terrorism?
I don't think there's a choice but to hope and to believe in it. There are other countries in the world who have had situations perhaps not as bad as, or perhaps not as complicated as Afghanistan. Cambodia, the civil society was destroyed. There were landmines. There were various leaders within the country who were waging a war, including the Khmer Rouge was just one of them. There were external powers that were contributors to the war, and it had Cambodia at this point has a peace process that was successful. Afghanistan can have the same thing with the will of the international community.
Mm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bruce is on the line, and you have a question about nation building.
Well, actually, I had kind of a proposal. I'm sure there's, you know, a lot of people in government who would shoot it down immediately. But I'm assuming that we're going to invade Afghanistan anyway. So if we are, I would say put in about 100,000 troops and create 33,000 man bases. That's about a brigade. and in each one build a hospital, a school, food, clothing, building materials distribution center in each one. And when people come up and we give them some food, find out what they can do, and you know, if they can, if they're carpenters, give them a hammer, give them some nails, give them some wood, let them build something.
The WPA reaches Afghanistan, and crucially, there, Rena, thank you for that call. Crucially, self-sustaining agriculture. What is it going to take so that the world community isn't going to have to feed these people perpetually?
I think one of them certainly is giving Afghanistan, that the Afghan people, the know-how, the technology, and the resources to be self-sustaining. I don't think that you should make Afghanistan reliant on the United Nations or other outside forces who come in and continue to provide support. Afghans are very independent people, and also people who are who acquire skills very easily. They're survivors. When you're a survivor, you are going to grasp at any opportunity that you have. So I think giving the type of technology and the assistance would be certainly one of the first steps.
Nab is on the line. Hello.
Hi there. Hello. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Very good. I wanted to just find out, and part of it is a question and part of it is a comment. It appears that countries in the region, other Arab countries, specifically Saudi Arabia, that has the influence and wealth and could step up to maybe over the years taking some of these refugees. It's not very either known to the public, or is it a well-kept secret? Is Saudi Arabia doing anything over the years to help the refugees and also with building the country? And when you hear other countries like India and others who have taken a lot of Afghan refugees that are less well off, does any of the people on the line know?
Good question. What about Saudi Arabia?
As far as I'm aware, I don't believe that Afghans are going to Saudi Arabia and large numbers to, as refugees. I know that Saudi Arabia has been one of the many parties who has been invested in and in backing their winner for the war. They've been backing the Taliban for the last several years financially.
Yes, and maybe the Afghans haven't gone to Saudi Arabia, but the Saudis sent one of theirs to Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden.
Not willingly. I don't want to blame the Saudis for that. I don't think that the Saudis wish that it wasn't one of theirs either. I don't think that Osama bin Laden represents any part of the Arab world, the Muslim world.
Indeed. Yeah. Briefly, very briefly, if you could tell President Bush one thing now, what would it be?
I would say take the humanitarian situation absolutely, completely seriously. I can rationally understand the bombing campaign, but at the same time, I think this situation has to take a multi-pronged approach. It has to have a humanitarian, a very serious, sustained a humanitarian action that is supported throughout this phase, and that the United States, as well as the United Nations, will have to put in a lot of investment into Afghanistan. I imagine that the United Nations and the United States and the international community will have to contribute to the rebuilding of Afghanistan for the next 10 years, and everyone should be prepared for that.
10 years.
Yes.
A Marshall Plan for Afghanistan.
This war is not an internal war. This war is something that has been supported, funded by
outside
many different countries.
Yes.
Now it's the moral imperative of these countries to build up Afghanistan again.
Thank you. Thank you, Rena Amiri and Gannett Gebrekristos. Gannett Gebrekristos is the regional representative for the UN High Commissioners on Refugees. Rena Amiri is an Afghan refugee and a student at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Thanks also to Joan Benaki of the Boston Globe. To continue the conversation, go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, navigating in a changed landscape, Ann Butler Rice spent 11 years in New York. In the absence of the World Trade Center, Rice has lost her bearings.
I was born and raised in Kansas, but for the last 11 years, I have been a New Yorker. My husband is a New Yorker. My neighbors were New Yorkers. My friends are New Yorkers. My family moved in June to Boston, and I've been missing New York. I yearned for the city long before September 11th, but its call has been so much louder in the weeks since. Last weekend, I packed up my husband and toddler to make our pilgrimage. As I sat in my mother-in-law's Brooklyn Heights brownstone on the promenade, I had a clear and expansive view of Lower Manhattan. From there, I've gazed countless hours across the East River to the shadowy giants speckled with random clusters of windows lit against the dark, like constellations in the night sky. I've seen those buildings shrouded in the fog of March mornings and glowing brilliant in reflected dawn. I've seen them silhouetted by the setting sun and obscured by torrential rain. They were always there, providing a familiar urban landscape as stunning as any mountain range or field of wheat. As we made our way into the city across the Whitestone Bridge and through Queens on the BQE, we traveled the length of Manhattan. I could easily locate Midtown, the Empire State Building, dressed in red, white, and blue, and the Chrysler Building, elegant as ever. They were markers guiding my path. I searched the horizon for Lower Manhattan. It was then that my disorientation began. When I looked across the river from the promenade, the disorientation strengthened. As I stood at Ground Zero, facing west across Liberty Street from Broadway, my disorientation was complete. The beacons that formed my compass in this city wilderness were gone. They are gone. I am trying to negotiate this disorientation. I need to be here to get my bearings, make contact with the beloved place and people here. It is part of my personal recovery plan. I need a means of processing the enormity of this loss and to find my direction in these bewildering days. You are here, says the subway map at Wall Street, but what I see is a hole. At night, it is literally that, a faintly luminous space peering out from between neighboring skyscrapers, lit for the crews working furiously to clean it, bandage it, heal it like an open wound. Now, more than a month after the wound was inflicted, and 2 days after our arrival, I see the first signs of recovery where the emptiness screamed before. I allow myself to see smiles, to hear laughter, and to walk barefoot in the lush grass in Battery Park, and to nod to the Statue of Liberty holding her torch up for the weary masses. During my pilgrimage, I saw a city resolute in its determination to heal, to defeat its intimidator, to prove its strength. I was able to confront the emptiness in myself and take a long look at the map of my soul. My Manhattan-born husband was never angrier with me than when I accused him of not being able to find his way somewhere in the city. New Yorkers pride themselves on their navigational skills. The disorientation that they must be feeling right now, the physical and psychological sensation of being lost, of loss itself, appears to be diminishing. It is bound to be a long and painful recovery, but it has begun. I know New Yorkers will find their way and themselves through this maze of despair and fear. They need only get hold of a new map and find the place that says, "You are here."
Ann Butler Rice lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How is the air war over Afghanistan or the anthrax scare here in the U.S. affecting you? Send your submissions, please, for future diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.